Welcome to my monthly podcast series titled Becoming a Sage. My name is Jan Fried, but you can call me Dr. Jan. In this series, I interview people to seek wisdom about living and leading a life on purpose. My passion is helping people find purpose and meaning in their lives on a daily basis for the rest of their lives, a concept I call breadcrumb legacy. I'm also on a mission to retire the word retirement. We're not retiring from life, but moving on to something else. And I believe it takes time and intentional thought to successfully move on to what's next in life. Today, I'm interviewing Bill George. Bill is a senior fellow at Harvard Business School, where he's taught leadership since 2004. He's the author of True North, Discovering Your True North, and several other books. He's the former chairman and chief executive of Medtronic, and joined in 1989 as president, chief operating officer, was chief executive officer from 91 to 2001, and board chair 96 to 2002. Bill serves on several boards, has received a great deal of recognition, and for more information about Bill, please refer to the bio posted at the end of this podcast. Well, welcome to the series, Bill.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jan. Good to be here. And all those things you said early on are music to my ears.
Okay, well, I've been a fan of yours since reading True North when it came out in 2007. I've read several of your articles over the years in Leader to Leader and Harvard Business Review. It's been fun to watch you in interviews. And today I want to explore the topics of leading in crisis. I want to talk a little bit about leaders in retirement, or I call moving on, and a leader's legacy. Mm-hmm. So this is very timely. You wrote a book called Seven Lessons for Leading in Crisis. What would be your best advice to leaders at all levels during this time?
Well, this is certainly timely. We're in the greatest crisis of my lifetime since I was too young for World War II and the Great Depression, thank goodness. But, crisis time hits you when you least expect it. And you don't know how it's going to come out. You don't know the outcome. There's a great deal of uncertainty associated with it. And so it takes a very different form of leadership than it does to manage during normal times. Normal times, you have time to plan, you have time to analyze, you have time to delegate, to hold, have big organization reviews and things like that. Everything has changed. In a crisis, you, the leader, must step up and take charge. And that's very clear. There's an article out just today about Jeff Bezos of Amazon, how he was worried about more about strategic issues and big picture issues and public issues. And now he's kind of stepped back in to take charge. I think that's totally appropriate. And you need to be on the firing line. And the first thing you need to do is face the reality of the crisis, to understand its depth, its implications for your organization. Some organization going to go bankrupt over this. We need to face those implications. What steps can you take now and take responsibility for everything that happens? There's no pushing it off on someone else, and you can hold other people accountable, but ultimately you're responsible for everything that happens in a crisis. So I think it's facing that reality. And sometimes that means looking yourself in the mirror and say, did I create that? Did I not have our company properly prepared? Did I not provide enough liquidity and a balance sheet that could weather a storm? Because we were giving two stock buybacks, we were leveraging our stock, we didn't have enough cash around. So shame on me. So I've got to face that reality and then go out and fix the problem. You don't blame it on your predecessor, you don't blame it on anyone else. You go out and take charge of getting it fixed.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great advice. And this kind of leads into my second question. If you were revising True North and discovering your True North, what would you change or delete if you were writing a new edition, based on what you've learned and experienced since then?
Well, I think I'd probably update it with some leaders in this pandemic, because what you see in a crisis is that different people step up and lead. And I think one of the things I want to emphasize right now is the value of the frontline workers. We have totally devalued them for the last 2-3 decades. We've substituted middle managers. And we substituted consultants. Nowhere is that more prevalent than in healthcare. I think the number of percentage of doctors in the last 25 years gone up about 40%, the rate of growth of the population. Percentage of administrators gone up 2,500%. And I have so many hospitals and healthcare organizations are hiring reams of consultants to come in and do their planning for them instead of building a capability. I think we need to get back to putting the emphasis on that first line person, that physician, that nurse, that technician, that orderly, who is in contact with the patient and making the difference. I just wrote a blog recently about one of my former students, Dr. Saka Ibrahim, who is at New York Presbyterian Hospital. And it's just so moving to read his posts about the compassion, but the uncertainty, the fear. And we don't realize here are people that are, they're like people going to fight a war to preserve our freedom, except these people are going to war with the COVID virus, not understanding it, to protect our lives. And they're risking their lives at the same time. So I think that's a good example. But I think the same applies to people working in a grocery store, working in a gas station, working in airlines, although no one's flying now, working in a restaurant. People are putting themselves on the line. And those are the people that we really need to honor and get back to, frankly, paying them a lot more money. We don't pay school teachers in our society nearly enough money. We don't pay nurses enough money. We should get nurses to do a lot of the work of doctors and upgrade their pay. And I think this is true of all frontline workers. And I think that means going to be a lot fewer middle managers and a lot fewer consultants and a lot fewer, lot less kind of what I call management 101.
Right. Well, it's interesting because, yeah, outside of healthcare, like you mentioned, restaurant and, you know, gas station. I mean, we're calling them essential workers.
Yeah.
The people who are working now are essential. And I find that very, we better reevaluate that. I think you're totally right. Well, you write about legacy in your books, and you wrote a great piece in Harvard Business Review recently about the CEO's Guide to Retirement. And I think leadership does have a shelf life. What mistake do you see leaders making too often when it comes to retirement? So I'm kind of shifting gears here a little bit because legacy is my passion.
Well, a lot of them are retiring earlier, not later, around 60. And you know, they've spent 30 years in leadership. They've got a lot more wisdom at age 60 than they certainly were at 30. And what do? They retire, move to Florida, and play golf 6 days a week. I think this is a tragedy. More leaders, I'm urging a lot of CEOs and other leaders at all walks of life, hey, rethink that. You're going to live today, good Lord willing, into your 90s. So why don't you keep going? There's so many things you can do. You don't have to be CEO, or you don't have to be head of some company or dean of a business school. You can go out. There's a lot of work you can do to really help other people. You can mentor younger leaders. You can share your wisdom. You can teach. There's so many things you can do. And I think it's a tragedy that people bail out just when they become the most skilled and the wisest. And I find on boards of directors, for instance, the wisest people are the people that have been CEO for 10 years. Now they got their aperture widened. They've got time freed up. This is a good time to do that. But you can't do it when you're spending most of your time in leisure time. You have to stay committed to really leadership and helping other people. And you've got to do it. Think about it every day, not just once a month.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, you're probably familiar with maybe Joseph Coughlin, who talks about 8,000 days. You know, we have 8,000 days beyond our main career. Well, how do you define legacy, Bill?
The first thing I'd say is that regardless of your religious beliefs or no religious beliefs at all, you can't take it with you. And I see way too many people hoarding the money they've earned. And I think the wealthier people are, the more likely they are to hoard, because they measure their self-worth by their net worth. And that's when you know you're in real trouble. So a legacy, the only thing you can do when you leave this earth is what you leave behind. That's your legacy. It's the people you touched. And by the way, it isn't necessarily being written up by the media or having a nice obituary. It's the individuals you touched in your life. It might be right in your own family, maybe your grandchildren. It may be individuals that worked in your company. They were first line people and you were kind to them. You were compassionate. You were concerned about them because they were ill or their wife was sick and you reached out to them. It's that kind of humanity. That's what you're remembered for. You're not remembered for the numbers. No one's going to ever remember what the numbers were when you were running a business or running a company or running an organization. What they're going to remember is who you were as a person. And so I think leaving a legacy, I think I view the time from 60 to 90 as a time of generativity when we give back. And one of the ways we give back is give back to other people. And that really if you will, that is your legacy and how much you care about people. When I go to memorial services and funerals, that's what I hear. I don't hear people saying, oh, this person was held this position as CEO of Honeywell, and he increased the net worth of the value of the company by 48%. No one talks like that. They say, he was there for me. He read me stories when I was a little boy, a grandson, you know?
Yeah. Well, given this concept of legacy, how do you think it has changed or will change given like COVID-19? You know, do you think people are thinking about it differently maybe?
Yeah, I think they're thinking about their lives. I mean, this is the first thing that's come along where we're all at risk. Let's be blunt. You know, the military officer who went to fight in Vietnam or Iraq were at risk. But we weren't. We're sitting back here in our cushy homes and cushy offices. We weren't at risk. They were. In fact, I kind of resent the civilians sending them to fight these wars for us, you know, and, you know, is it really something you want to do? But setting that aside, I admire their bravery. I have lots of students who are retired military officers. I have huge, enormous respect for their bravery. But I think it really gets down to how are we going to think about our life? This threatens everyone. Katrina didn't threaten everyone. The Deepwater Horizon down in the Gulf of Mexico, that didn't threaten everyone. This threatens everyone. The financial community thing, you know, it in a sense, it didn't threaten people's lives. It threatened their economic. Mm-hmm. And as I heard Governor Cuomo say, what's the difference? You lose your life, you don't get it back. You lose your financial position, you can get it back. You can earn that back. You can come back up. But, and so I think, this is going to really change a lot of people's perspective. I think there's a spiritual side to this, and we're going to reconnect with the spiritual side of our life. That's not a religious statement, but our humanity of who we are, what's our purpose in life, and rethink about that. Never was thinking through our purpose in life more important. It can't be just to improve our net worth. It can't be just to have a bigger home or a larger car or fancier vacations. If that's all it is, you know, why are we here on earth? And I think that gets down to this causes us to rethink what's the meaning of our life? Why are we here on earth?
Right. No, I couldn't agree more. And those are great words. What do you think gets in the way of people leaving a legacy or thinking about it or any obstacles? Or can you think of a story where people... a legacy story, either on where they did leave a great legacy or where they didn't. I mean, I maintain that, you know, these breadcrumbs, they accumulate. Yeah. And they really add up. And so it's like you said, the little things that we do, although it can be lost overnight, if you think about, you know, and organizations can lose it over, you know, with, you know, Enron or, you know, or people can lose it overnight. You know, Charlie Rose or, yeah.
Well, that says, now you're getting off into behavior. So let me just say,
yeah,
when you're in any kind of leadership role or visible role, unfortunately, I think our society values celebrity way too much. I think we way overvalue celebrity. But I think when you're in any kind of visible role, in any kind of leadership role, whether you're principal of a high school or you're, you know, you're head of a hospital, your role, your behavior has to be above reproach. You're the role model for everyone else. You don't do marginal things ethically. You set the ethical standard for everyone in your organization. And you set a standard that you care about them. I've talked to 18 CEOs in the last week. What are you thinking about reopening? Because there's a lot of talk about reopening. They say, we're not going to reopen. I don't care what any politician tells us. We're not reopening until we can ensure the safety of our employees. And if we're a consumer-facing industry, we have to ensure the safety of our customers. Best Buy, CEO of Best Buy, she has 1,000 stores, you know, and had 125,000 people, had to lay off. But they can't just open those stores until they can ensure that any customer walks in is safe. Mm-hmm. And that any employee feels safe interacting with customers. So that comes first. And no one can order her to reopen her stores until she can meet those two criteria. And that's going to require a lot more science and follow the medicine. But I think that's what people are thinking right now is how do you do that? Mm-hmm. I heard that your governor just is opening up the tattoo parlors and the beauty shops and all those things down in Georgia. And I went to college in Atlanta, at Georgia Tech, and I'm a little shocked at that because I've been talking to the president of Georgia Tech and the dean of Harvard Business School. All they think about is the safety of their students. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you got to think about.
Right. Well, it's going to take a lot of courage because, you know, now there are protesters in various states and cities saying, it's time to reopen. And I, how long do you think that this might last?
Well, these are not organic protests. These are well-organized.
Yes, they are organized.
This is
right.
A political movement. This
yes.
is not
yes.
a health movement.
Yes, it is.
I think we need to think about what's an essential business. I was just before I joined you today, I was talking to senior people at Mayo about Mayo reopening because they have, you know, right now hospitals are deferring women with breast cancer from having their surgeries. Well, you can't do that for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And they don't have COVID, but you need to find a safe way to get them in there and do their mastectomy.
Yes.
You can't. I heard a hospital here in the Twin Cities is deferring 30,000 mastectomies. That's not safe. That's
right.
That's an essential work. You need
yes.
to find a way to get people back into those things up and running. That's essential. If you're making food, we've just closed a pork plant in Worthington, Minnesota. There are about 6 pork plants. There's a big one down in Iowa. There's 2 in South Dakota, 1 in Wisconsin, 1 in Canada, all closed. Well, we need to get food to people. People need to eat, whether it's pork or whether it's vegetables or asparagus. But we need to create a safe work environment. So I talked to the CEO of one of the world's largest food companies, and he said, you know, and he happened to have one of these plants. He said, our number one concern is safety. So we're going to have to put in we're going to have to reorganize all our assembly plants. We cannot have that. We don't even want people who may be diseased to touch any food they're going to pack and then ship it out to. We just can't afford this. So they're very conscientious. I really admire this group of CEOs. One of the things that happens, Jan, I found is that when there is a vacuum at the top, other leaders step up. And I think I'm encouraged. I talked to the CEO of one of the largest investment bank in the world. And I said to him, I said, you know, you're going to find the people that step up are not necessarily the people with the big titles in your organization that have been doing all the management things just right. You're going to find the people that know how to step up in a crisis are very different. So those are the people you want to talk to. If we have a safety crisis, my former company, Medtronic, I want to talk to the scientist that knows the most about this. I talk to a metallurgical engineer or the people on the firing line that really understand, is this safe? The doctors that work for us and then other doctors, bring in a panel of them. So I think it's a different set of people that really step, and that's what I'm trying to emphasize. That's what's really important.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. Well, I could talk to you all day long, and I know you're a busy person, and I really appreciate the time you've given me. So I always like to kind of close with, what else should I have asked you that people need to know, either about leadership or, and actually, I do want to ask you one other question before this. So I always struggle, you know, I teach leadership, and I always struggle with when we talk about authenticity. What if somebody's an authentically bad person? So they are being authentic, but they're not a good person.
Actually, there's no such thing.
There's no such thing
as an authentically bad person.
Okay.
Person, there's a reason why you're so angry. Now, let's go back and process the crucibles. What things happened to you that got you? You got beaten up by your father. You heard your parents yell, shout, and scream, and you shut down your emotions because they got divorced and it was a horrible situation. You saw your father or your mother lose their jobs, and your father left the family, and your mother had no money, and you didn't eat, and you're angry. You got to address that. Don't carry that anger with you the rest of your life. You can't go through life leading it. And maybe there's a pearl in there. Maybe you can help other people with that situation. Maybe that's your career calling. So I think people who don't tell the truth, why do you not tell the truth? There's something in your character. No, you're not born not telling the truth. You're not born lacking. You can develop your empathy. You know, it's hard to develop your IQ, but you can develop compassion and empathy.
Right.
But you can't do it if you're angry. And so you need to take that shell down and not say, oh, I'm not going to think about that. I'm not going to think about what happened. Actually, you need to. You need to go back and process. Maybe you got fired from your job at age 40. Maybe it was unfair. Maybe you got caught in a political battle. Maybe your spouse, your husband walked out on you. I don't know what it is, but you need to process that. And when you do, then you can find your authentic self, because that your authentic self is not an angry person.
Okay.
This is a myth that some academics have put up there. There's no such thing. By the way, there's also no such thing as been put out there, the idea that you have low self-awareness and you're an authentic leader. You have to have high self-awareness. So
yes.
Just you know, they're saying, well, what if people that are always putting people down, they make inappropriate comments about women, or they're putting down people of other races, or they don't like people or LGBT. Hey, that's your problem. That's not their problem. I have a friend who's a grandson of a slave, is now head of the world's largest drug company, Merck. And he said, you know, I say, what do you do when people discriminate against you, Ken? He said, Bill, I'm not going to stoop to their level. That's their problem. That's not my problem. I can't help it. My skin's black. So if you do that, that's not being that. There's no such thing as has been put out there, low self-monitoring. I mean, that's not being authentic. That's what 15-year-old boys do. And, you know, the things they say about women. I mean, come on, that's just immaturity.
Right. Okay, great. So I want to be very respectful of your time. So what else do you want to share with us? Last words of wisdom on leadership or authenticity or leading a crisis, anything, legacy, anything.
What is your purpose? What's the purpose of your leadership? Why are you leading? You know, leadership, a lot of times, not a lot of fun, you know? And I talked to the head of Goldman Sachs, or you serve on the board, and he's all alone at the office. It's hard to get the company back up and running. And he feels safe, but, you know, it's these are tough times. You know, they're very, very tough times. So why do you do it? You do it because you want to serve. And you've got a calling in life to make a difference. My purpose had to change dramatically. When I went to Medtronic, I said, wow, I found my purpose. I can identify with the idea of restoring people to full life and health. And how many more people do we take care of? They just published yesterday that, you know, he'd gone from like one every 100 seconds to two per second. Well, that's a huge order, several orders of magnitude increase. That's what I was. But then I left Medtronic at 58, 59, and retired just on my 60th birthday. But, you know, honestly, I had to find a new purpose. So my purpose now has come to be to try to influence leaders like the people listening into this call. That's my input. But see, what I hope for you, and it took me a while to find this, is that you can find an alignment between your personal purpose and your company's purpose. If you can't, you're in the wrong job. You're in the teaching profession, Jan. It's easy to find an alignment there. Your purpose, I hope, is to help people become better people, better leaders in whatever your field is, maybe better finance wizard if you teach finance. But I think you need to have clarity about that. So if you're in an organization that you have good values and the organization has bad values, eventually it's not going to work. It happened to me early in my career, my mid-30s. I had to move on because my business had very good values, but the corporation, very marginal. So you just got to get out of that environment. Otherwise, it's going to rub off. So I want to see that alignment first of all, it takes a while to figure out your purpose. You have to go through understanding your true north. You can't, your purpose is like your North Star. But you got to understand your true north, the essence, who you are. And so until you discover your true north, you can't find your purpose. So that's the first step. Then you think about, that's why purpose comes later in the book, because then you find your purpose. And then, you find your true north. Then you can discover what is your purpose. Maybe you had that life-threatening illness and you want to become a doctor. That becomes your purpose of saving lives. That's what my son's doing. And his wife are both doctors, saving lives and doing surgery every day. Okay, that has become his purpose. So can you find that alignment? Eventually, if you can't, you should move on to something where you do find alignment, because you don't want to go through life just working for someone else and not having any sense of meaning. You need to find that meaning, because at the end of the day, you look back and say, wow, it wasn't perfect. We made a lot of mistakes, but wow, it was an amazing time. We really helped a lot of people. Right. So you become a true servant leader.
Right. No, I definitely believe in servant leadership. So, well, you've given us so much to think about, and the emphasis in this series is on learning how to make the rest of life the best of life. So may the best of life be for you, and we'll continue to follow you.
Well, I'll follow you. So thank you for your work.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you. Take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.